A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I think my eventual aim is to be able to feel completely alone around other people. When I'm noticing other people when I don't want to, it's from a place of anxiety. When I'm noticing them and I do want to, that's curiosity. Like, I don't mind at all when I'm lost in my thoughts and then I see a really cool pair of shoes and then I'm drawn to them. But when I'm snapped out of my thoughts by just the sudden approach of someone, I don't like that constant state of fearfulness. My body is primed for attack in ways that I maybe wouldn't alone in my apartment, because nothing is particularly going to snap me out of it.
Hi, and welcome to Alonement, the podcast about time alone and why it matters. I'm Francesca Spector, host of this podcast and author of Alonement, a book based on this very show. I'm also a reformed extreme extrovert who, a few years ago, discovered the life-changing benefits of spending time alone. Each week, I interview someone I'm curious about to discover what solo time means to them. In every conversation, we celebrate the unique benefits of time spent alone, regardless of your age, life stage, or relationship status. Because when alone time isn't lonely, it's alonement. This week's guest is author Neisha Dolan. I'm absolutely thrilled to have Neisha on this season. She is widely considered one of the millennial generation's most talented writers. Ever since her Sunday Times bestseller debut novel, Exciting Times, which was published in 2020. It's currently being adapted into an Amazon Studios TV production starring Phoebe Dernevar. So that's pretty good for your first novel, isn't it? It's currently being adapted into an Amazon Studios TV production starring Phoebe Dernevar from Bridgerton. So yeah, not bad for your first novel. We're here to discuss her hotly anticipated follow-up, The Happy Couple, which is sort of an anti-rom-com, counting down to the wedding of a boy and a girl who probably shouldn't get married. During this recording, we chat about Neisha's experience of being an expat in Berlin, where she's lived less than a year. Fans of Neisha, who is originally from Dublin, will know that she is no stranger to the experience of living abroad. Her first book, Exciting Times, was heavily inspired by her own expat experience living in Hong Kong, while she's also lived in Singapore and Italy. From an alone time perspective, this is an interesting position to be in, and Neisha describes how this sense of being a foreigner has enabled some of that incredibly perceptive social observation that her writing is famous for. We also discuss Neisha's autism diagnosis and how it might or might not reflect itself in her writing, plus whether framing writing as neurodivergent in the first place is useful. I'm going to stop summarizing our conversation at this point and let you hear the real deal. But suffice to say, I had a great time recording. I found Neisha incredibly thoughtful and intelligent. She has a dark sense of humor, which I really appreciate. And she has one of the best laughs, probably the best laugh I've ever heard on this podcast. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. This season is brought to you by Westlab, the UK's number one trusted bath salts brand. Their best-selling Dead Sea bath salt range contains minerals that come from the famous waters themselves. Fun fact, it's actually a lake, not a sea, that's found in the lowest point of the earth and was the world's first spa, visited by Cleopatra herself. Dead Sea Salt is a skin hero, containing a unique blend of magnesium, calcium, and potassium, which is brilliant for protecting and repairing your skin barrier and managing conditions like eczema, psoriasis, acne, and sensitive skin, together with soothing any aching muscles. I'm also kind of in love with magnesium for its mood balancing qualities. It's nice to think that your mind and body are being looked after while you're soaking there in the tub. West Lab Dead Sea Bath Salts are vegan, cruelty-free, and suitable for the whole family, including babies aged 3 months and up. Use the code ALONEMENT15 for 15% off when you spend £10 or more. T's and C's in the show notes.
So you're living in Berlin at the moment, I've seen from the press that you've been doing around your new book, The Happy Couple. How long has it been the case that you've lived there? Since last July, so around 10 months.
How's that experience been? How's Berlin treating you?
I really like it. It's a very mind your own business kind of place, but equally there's always plenty to observe. Precisely because it's a mind your own business place, people act on the assumption that no one is particularly watching or monitoring them. And so you can see plenty of weird shit if you're nosy, but equally nobody's going to be very nosy about you. So it's a writer's paradise, like people watching for days.
That's so interesting. And where's your favorite spot to people watch?
I really love the canal, and that's such a non-specific location. It's like saying you love the canal in London, but really anywhere along it, because like first of all, water is always a calming presence, and also all the tiny birds. I love the way their heads twitch, and I like watching people walk their dogs and speculating about what made this person choose this kind of dog. So there is plenty to observe along the canal. I guess that's true in every city, but definitely in Berlin.
And we're here to discuss novel 2, but I'm sensing that novel 3 might be set in Berlin.
It could be.
Keeping my eyes peeled for that announcement. And so how has your time in Berlin been from the perspective of alone time? Moving to a foreign country is not new for you. You've lived in Hong Kong and Singapore, I believe, as well as living in Berlin now. How has this experience of sort of expat solo living been for you?
Really nice, actually. Because of the self-reparenting experience of learning a new language, because wherever you are, you're going to have insecurities about how you come across and whether you're communicating what you want to communicate. And the best way to avoid that is by never leaving your hometown. But even within your hometown, certainly I found you're still going to worry how you come across. So to have this useful thing to constantly blame for me is actually quite reassuring and therapeutic. Like, oh, it was just my German. Oh, it was just my German. As opposed to, oh, it was me as a person. Oh, it was me as a person. So yeah, I think there's always going to be friction between person and environment. And when you can blame the friction on something else, in some ways it makes it easier.
That's really interesting, actually. I never really thought about it like that. I think people say it's a cliche, right? To say you can be lonely in a crowded room. Less so a cliche to say you can be lonely in your sort of hometown or your familiar surroundings. And yet, I think we all know that that's a universal experience, that friction we sometimes feel about fitting in. So to think that, I don't know, there's a normalization that feels comforting about moving to a different country and having something to scapegoat almost.
Yeah, totally. Like in Germany, it's considered quite rude not to make eye contact with someone after you've toasted together. And I learned this rule and realized that a lot of people had been presumably giving me foreigner slack on this count, because I definitely had not done the eye contact when they did that. But then I thought, hang on, is that a norm in Ireland or not? And I couldn't remember. So quite possibly, I have also offended many Irish people by not doing this, and they definitely wouldn't have been cutting me foreigner slack. So yeah, I'll take the foreigner slack if it's going.
And I want to pick up on what you said before about the eye contact in Berlin and how that's become something you're noticing being there, because you've spoken a lot about being diagnosed with autism at the age of 27, and you've done a lot of interviews about that. There's something you describe called masking, which is hiding or disguising your natural responses in order to act like a more neurotypical person, whatever that is. And in a piece for the Times, you said that masking is something that autistic women quite often will do, and that they often end up being the most socially intelligent people because they're so often watching the people around them. Have you found yourself having to make those mental leaps, or having to observe more about the people around you being in this strange new city that you've lived in less than a year?
I suppose it's difficult to disentangle from cultural considerations that anyone would make. So for instance, especially in the former East Germany, smiling too often will get you perceived as a simpleton. It's just not as smiley a culture as America. And the stereotype that many Germans have of Americans is that they're always smiling for no good reason. And of course, Americans are the precise opposite stereotype of Germany. I think probably the UK and Ireland are somewhere in between there on the smiling scale. But then where do you draw the line between that, which probably anyone would notice and care about, and the level of thought that I might put into it about how much should I then smile? And yeah, I suppose autism is a factor, but not the factor in that.
Yeah. I mean, you are very interested in people generally. You've said before in interviews that for you, relationships, they are the plot of your novels. That is what fascinates you. Do you think there's something in your living in different countries that just almost brings up this new area of interest for you, of observation?
Yeah, I think having seen how many ways people are fundamentally similar in it, probably does center people as a worthy subject in and of itself, because I'm under no illusion that specific things are particular to the Irish. Of course, some other things are, but I think the more you've seen patterns and tendencies replicated wherever you go, the more it seems like people are the focus. But I think the greater reason is just that when I'm reading, I'm always looking for the people and I will always find them. And even if there are 40 descriptive passages of something with no people in it at the start of a novel, I will force myself through those to get to the people, because the people are what I enjoy in that novel. So I then probably don't write the bits that I would tend to skip in someone else's novel. And like, I think that's universal. I don't think anyone deliberately writes material that they themselves would skip, but we have different bits that we enjoy, I guess.
Yeah, I really relate to that idea of, no matter how beautiful a description is, it will always seem a bit, I don't know, what's the critical word? It will always seem a bit flowery to me if it's not got something animate in it.
Yeah, yeah. And I sometimes wonder if I'm being ungenerous, because my motivation for writing a long descriptive passage would be to impress some creative writing teacher in my head. But that's me. And quite possibly I'm then projecting that motivation onto someone else's prose, when for them it's expressing something inside them. I don't know. All I know is it's not really my bag, although it really depends on the writer. Like, I'm always saying I don't like this or that in fiction, but then if someone does it well, there's always the exception. Like Nabokov, I would read literally anything by. He never needs people to catch my attention, although they're always there eventually. So if it's good, it's going to be good.
So some writers can do it.
Yeah, just write good. That would be my writing advice to anyone who wishes to hear what I think.
You've described how you will stand on the canal and sort of, or sit on the canal. Betray this for me, this vantage point that you have on the canal. Will you be sitting in a cafe or sort of walking along? How are you observing people to begin with?
Well, I swim in the canal. Typically.
You're swimming?
No.
With a notepad. No.
Yeah, no, there are various positions that my body finds itself in the vicinity of the canal. There are often coffee shops along it, and there is a great love in Berlin of sitting outside whenever you possibly can. I think we have this in common with London, that somehow temperatures that in Southern Europe would not warrant this are considered virtually tropical in these otherwise grim cities. And so, you know, if it's 16 degrees and it's cloudy, people will be like, well, this is a coffee outside day, isn't it? So I do that a lot. I also like walking along the canal. And sometimes I'll just stand on one of the bridges for ages and watch the water, and I suppose just try to notice what's happening in my body and also what's happening around me, and keep an alertness of both those things. And it's really nice and soothing, and helps me become a bit less obsessed with the past and the future, which are otherwise my harrowing constant concerns.
And does that count as alone time for you? Is that what you consider being solitary, or do you need a different kind of it to give you time off from this state of observation?
I think it depends. I think for me, there are two shades of alone time. There's alone time where I forget that I exist. So when I'm reading a really good book, or when I'm writing fiction, or even when I'm doing something like yoga and I'm not thinking about me so much as I'm thinking about the instructions and following them. But then there's also self-examining alone time. So where I might write in my journal or stand and try to notice how I feel. And I think I need a bit of both, really. But I think my eventual aim is to be able to feel completely alone around other people, because when I'm noticing other people when I don't want to, it's from a place of anxiety. When I'm noticing them and I do want to, that's curiosity. Like, I don't mind at all when I'm lost in my thoughts and then I see a really cool pair of shoes and then I'm drawn to examine the outfit as a whole or whatever. But when I'm snapped out of my thoughts by just the sudden approach of someone, I don't like that constant state of fearfulness. Obviously, you need a degree of vigilance in a big city, but that degree of vigilance is so much lower than the degree that I just natively experience in my body for some reason. So, yeah, I think having other people around me as I try to have my alone time is, in that sense, a good way to notice the ways in which my body is primed for attack in ways that I maybe wouldn't alone in my apartment, because nothing's particularly going to snap me out of it. But still, obviously, subconsciously, I'm braced to hear that sound or whatever. And that's why sometimes I jump at the sound of my boiler.
Because you are so sort of absorbed in that time by yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, and at the same time, not entered completely into it, or else the boiler just wouldn't bother me, like it would register.
Alone time more generally, just to sort of broaden that out, what does the word alone historically, or even just now, mean to you?
I think the connotation has definitely changed from a negative to a positive one over the years, because when I was a kid, I always felt incredibly isolated, and so finding ways to fill the alone time was a necessity, whereas nowadays I could spend all day every day with people if I wanted, and so the fact that the alone time is a choice makes it much easier to frame it to myself as a treat. So nowadays it's me time. Back then it was in dark the intonation, me time. Like, oh great, me again. Is that what we're getting?
Oh, me again time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Always with the me time.
We're just always coming out with these beautifully worded phrases.
Thank you. It's almost like I'm employed to do so.
It's almost like you're a best-selling author. Yeah. So why is it your aim to feel alone around other people rather than just feeling alone when you're alone?
I think it gives me a lot more control over the situations in which I can be happy. I don't like standing in queues and being annoyed by someone's voice because I'm hungry and there are 20 people in front of me and when's my focaccia coming and whatever. So being able to tune in and out of will, I think, is a good thing to train. Yeah, yeah. And maybe it's not so much about people as general external influences. Like, I equally would like to be better than I am at drowning out an ambulance outside or what have you. Although I guess to some extent that's always going to be a losing battle. Like, there's some things that our nervous system is just designed to notice, and that's why they choose that sound for an ambulance, so that you won't be able to tune out the ambulance and get run over.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're about to get onto the book in a moment, but it makes me think what you're saying about being able to disassociate from other people. It makes me think of your protagonist, Celine, in The Happy Couple, and how she's able to, she's a pianist and she's able to play piano in her head. Were you projecting, is this a sort of superpower that you'd want to be able to do, that state of absorption?
Yeah, I suppose that was a combo of how I've gone about teaching myself other things and how I imagine that might apply to a field that I never got truly good at. So anything that I consider myself really good at, I can do in my head on command. And it's a really soothing and fun thing to be able to do. And it also reinforces your knowledge of the thing as you go about your day, because then you don't need to be in this specific setup to actually do the thing. So yeah, and completely, potentially I'm completely off base about how it would actually look for a musician, but I think it doesn't really matter to me if it's quote unquote accurate or not. It just matters, like, does it work in the page? And hopefully it does.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a real tendency sometimes to, I don't know, there's a trap to fall into being an author writing a book about being an author or a journalist or some sort of writer. So I loved that your choice of protagonist there brought so much. So The Happy Couple is framed around an engagement party and a wedding. And as a writer who identifies as queer, what was it that appealed about framing a book around a historically very sort of heterosexual, heteronormative convention?
I think initially it was just to give my writing a bit of structure, because when I'm writing the first draft of something, there's an element of needing to interest myself. And for that reason, I can't plan too much, because if I'm not wondering what will happen next, then I'm not going to be transfixed enough to finish the draft. But equally, if I completely make it up as I go along, then I'm going to have to do a lot of work down the line that I could have avoided having to do by planning a bit smarter up front. So I decided to split the difference by having a big event that it's counting down to. And that way I can still make up things up as I go, but there's going to be inherently something framing it and tying it together. And I think a wedding was just the most obvious thing for characters that age. And that's honestly the reason that I chose it up front. But then as I wrote, I became interested in why that was the default, why that it didn't appear to me that a wedding rather than anything else is the default thing to give people in their late 20s to be organizing towards, as opposed to a birthday party or what have you. So yeah, my own snap assumption then became a point of interrogation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're the same age. I'm 31. I think we're about the same age. And yeah.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The 31 Club.
The 31 Club.
Isn't like the 27 Club. I hope 31 is something better in line. At least we didn't fall prey to the poor 27 Club coming.
Hopefully we don't die to begin with. I hope.
Well, I think eventually that hope will be dashed.
Yes. But hopefully we have at least a while. But I do think the interesting thing about this early 30s stage is that, like, 30, you would just spend the whole year trying to justify all those people that told you, oh, like, you'll turn 30, your brain will totally change, and you won't care about what anyone thinks, and like almost trying to get off on that. 31, you're very much in your 30s. And the reality of that is it's not just a framing device for a book. Your life is punctuated by engagement parties and weddings, and those, again, very heteronormative historically situations. So there's a reason there's so many books framed around these. Marianne Keyes described your book as nihilistic about heteronormative relationships, which you shared on Instagram. So I'm assuming you quite liked that verdict on the book. Would you agree with it?
Well, I think most of all, I just appreciated it as a bit of English. That woman has a matchless way with words. But I think the version of nihilism that I subscribe to and support is that you can make of life whatever you want version. And I think nihilism gets a bad rap as being about nothing mattering, when it's more like nothing matters and therefore you can choose what will matter to you. So to me, nihilism about heteronormativity is more, we have the power to observe what's going on and to really some extent stop doing it if we don't want to.
How do you feel about, well, the whole convention of weddings, especially as someone who's now spent quite a bit of time writing about one?
Well, I've only actually been to one because around the time my friends started getting married was just when COVID hit. But of the people I know who got them engaged and married, they all seem to be having a great time. But I think that's precisely because it's something that they've chosen and not something that was viewed as mandatory for them. And maybe that's elective, maybe it's the sort of people that I'm friends with. But while I can't really make a society-wide diagnosis for that reason, I think something that people pick for themselves with a full appreciation of other things that they can do is probably still going to be right for them. It's just if the full spectrum of possibilities isn't visible or doesn't seem viable to them, then you see people doing things that they don't really want to do.
Do you think that that's the case for your protagonist, Celine? Do you think that the full spectrum of her options is available for her?
I guess she's a funny one in that respect, because I think probably her chief problem is that she's not a very detailed or rigorous examiner of her own life. I think we see her escaping from it in various ways much more than we see her truly putting the spotlight on her choices. And obviously that's something that's difficult to convey at points, because what I was trying to do was nonetheless make the reasons for those choices apparent to the reader without necessarily giving her a level of insight that she personally does not have. But I think that's how you end up with these paradoxes, where on one level, she is completely free to do pretty much whatever she wants, but because of a lack of attention as to how she feels, she winds up defaulting into decisions that seem on the face of it bizarre.
Have you heard this conversation around main character syndrome at the moment?
I've heard the phrase, but I don't know what the conversation specifically is. It's just like everyone thinking that they're the center of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think your main character lacks main character syndrome herself?
I think they've all got main character syndrome in various ways, but I suppose hers manifests as only thinking about the things that are immediately pleasurable to think about and only thinking about anything else for as long as it takes to dispel the bad thoughts.
Yeah.
And that inability to sit in discomfort and just accept that it's a thing that you'll have to deal with to work through things then causes her to stay in these cycles where she causes herself long-term way more discomfort than if she just listened to her instinct the first time. So I think in that way, you can be incredibly self-centered while actually not thinking about yourself in useful ways at all.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking there's that bit where, spoiler alert, but, you know, Luke's gone missing from the engagement party early on in the book. And she sort of reasons, it's very strange. She reasons, oh, but, you know, but life is beautiful and I'll forgive him. And you're reading it thinking, no, don't do that. But, but also it's, if not relatable, definitely it feels like someone, you know, it feels like a friend making poor decisions. It feels very realistic. And I think it's interesting because she is someone that is so in love with her art. She plays piano for 5 hours a day. And the only reason she plays for only 5 hours is because she's worried she'll get tendonitis if she continues playing for longer. Otherwise, she's always in her head playing piano. We sort of celebrate that absorption as a good thing. I think an image of someone alone playing the piano, that would seem like a, I don't know, a societally rewarded great state of aloneness, that, you know, a great way to use your alone time. Do you think you're sort of almost revealing, I don't know, that the potential hurdles in that, in being so absorbed in one's art, that it can come to the detriment of one's relationships or happiness?
I think suddenly there's a failure of imagination in some ways underlying that way of living, because surely, given that art is produced as a result of absorbing and synthesizing things that exist in the natural world, the natural world also has that beauty to begin with, right? And I mean the natural world very broadly. Like, it can mean one's sitting room, it can mean even being on one's laptop, in that it's a thing that exists. And so if there's only one very specific hobby where someone can enjoy being alive and the rest of it is just treading water, that in some way exposes their limitations, and those limitations probably come through in their art also.
It's an interesting way to look at it. I mean, I'm still very jealous of anyone that can play piano, but as you say, when it's the central thing, the central focus in your life, it can also come with a sort of risk factor. And I was intrigued by the fact that she is described somewhere, I think earlier on in the book, as generally a hermit, but somehow she seems unable to be single. And she, you know, she's in and out of relationships. What interested you about this tension?
I think it's another area where her lack of curiosity about life in general really comes to bear, because that's what underlies all cliche, I think. It's not an active intention to reproduce a cultural image. It's a lack of asking questions that would then reveal the cliche in some way. And so the clichés that Tolleen readily subscribes to in her life, like I as a woman need a partner, or I as a woman currently with a man to conduct my relationship in the following way, are things where that critical thinking goes out the window, and where her narrow conception of what it means to be an artist, I think, comes to bite her.
What hole do you think she's trying to fill if she's got already so much absorption in her art?
Probably to some extent the relationship with Luke is a result of not truly dealing with the sorrow after losing her ex-girlfriend Maria. Like, we do see her processing and dealing with that a little bit, but the conclusion she draws is then she fixed it by finding someone else. And that relationship was rooted in her art, but became unworkable precisely because the partner shared that art was also a pianist. This is identified as a problem, that the way they both practice is pretty incompatible in the long term. But then the solution, be with someone who is not a pianist and who lets her go through the whole relationship with essentially one foot out, doesn't seem to work too well for her either.
Yeah. I noticed a parallel between Celine and your character Ava in Exciting Times, who is also quite a solitary person who is living in Hong Kong, and she's moved from Dublin to Hong Kong. She's got the early loneliness and difficulty of being an expat, and she sort of has the prospect of healthy connections with people from work, with flatmates, but she ditches it in favor of a relationship with Julian, a character who, well, not exactly like Luke, that, you know, there are definitely parallels, perhaps most prominently in the fact they're not particularly nice people sometimes, or certainly the relationship dynamic can be quite unhealthy. Do you think there's a form of self-sabotage in these characters?
I suppose, considering each of them in turn, I think Ava in Exciting Times has a much more palpable insecurity around not having a thing, and about, I suppose, her cultural capital in general, and so is drawn to someone who makes her feel intelligent and important and all the rest of it, in some ways precisely because he's not always the nicest guy. I think for whatever reason, someone as young and insecure as her can often associate what's just meanness with intelligence, although I don't think he's entirely bad either. I think probably anyone I spend more than three paragraphs on isn't going to be entirely bad, because I write with acute awareness that everyone has main character syndrome and nobody is consciously and knowingly the villain. But yeah, with Celine, I'm not sure. Like, I think the thing about self-sabotage is nobody knows that they're doing it in the moment. It's only post hoc we look back and we're like, okay, so doing what was in my best interest would in that scenario have involved a bunch of immediate cognitive discomfort as I try to do stuff that I'm not used to doing or whatever. And so I just reverted to the old pattern or what have you. But in the moment, I think self-sabotage invariably feels like we're acting intelligently and correctly and in our best interest. So I suppose what unites these women is that some sort of social force and some personal cocktail arising from those social forces has convinced these women that something's in their best interest, and that's what they believe that they are doing for as long as they are doing it. Not always uncomplicatedly, like not always with an awareness that maybe it's not in their best interest, but they think that what they're doing makes sense enough to keep doing it until it doesn't.
So self-sabotage is effectively self-protection, albeit self-protection without much thought behind it.
Yeah, or self-protection with the wrong kind of thought behind it. Like if there's something else that you want to do, but you obsess over potential negative things that could come from it. I would say Ava is probably more of a negative ruminator and more of an anxious character, whereas Celine is probably more of a like, don't go there.
Yeah. Yeah. As a more of a sort of, I don't know, compartmentalizer or even just escapist.
Yeah. Like the please update your laptop notification comes up and she clicks away every time until the laptop forcibly updates itself at a time that is very inconvenient for her and that she loses a lot of work.
Yes. That
Not
resonated.
To say the metaphor at all.
No, that's a very universal experience. That's all I can say.
Please update your laptop at tragedy by Nietzsche today, and that'll be the third one.
Be the third one written in Berlin.
Yes.
Yeah. And this might feel like a weird question because it's hard to say how you would write like anyone other than who you are. But what do you think or suspect that your neurodivergent perspective brings to your writing?
Yeah, well, like you say, it's difficult to pinpoint because every feature that I would associate with my writing, I can think of a completely opposite writing style that one could also link with that person and being autistic. For example, the fact that my description tends to be quite short and blunt, which one could argue mirrors stereotypical autistic communication styles. But equally, if someone had a very sensory writing style where every scent and every touch was lingered over for ages, you could say, well, that's a really autistic writing style because autistic people have more attuned senses. Or if someone went completely the opposite way and with more Hemingway than me even and had literally none of the sensory stuff, then you could say, well, that's an autistic writing style because some autistic people are hypo as opposed to hypersensitive. So yeah, I suppose I would be wary in that sense of pinpointing it on any one thing. Like, I think overwhelmingly, I just see myself as an artist who makes choices and selects a particular style because it's the style I want to write in. But what makes it autistic is the fact that it's my autistic brain making those choices.
Do you feel like there's a pro to characterizing or even having these conversations of, as you say, like an autistic writing style, because it brings attention to the amazing parts of the autistic brain, even if that's in two totally different ways?
I think it depends on the tone and the attention, because I'm not interested in arguing for the worthiness of autistic people based on what they can do. Like, that seems to me an inherently ableist way of thinking in itself. But on the other hand, given how long untold numbers of autistic people have spent their whole lives masking without knowing, and the amount of energy that has gone into that instead of into doing something interesting and rewarding, I think visibility is good in the hope that it will help more people out of that trap. And then that will be of benefit to literature generally, because for every autistic genius who happened to manage to break through that, there are so many more who didn't and who spent their whole lives lying to themselves and to everyone else about who they are in a really tragic way, and we will never hear their stories. So I hope more of them don't get lost, and in that sense I think visibility is really good.
And also, I think almost changing perceptions. I think I read in an interview you said that autistic boys, they're often seen to be obsessed with numbers, whereas for you, you were fixated on words and punctuation, and that comes across so much in your writing and how, you know, it almost reframes that level of attention and detail. But as you say, you know, there's not just one specific style of writing that comes from having that neurodivergent perspective. It really is just about exploring the different ways in that, how that can come across.
Yeah, and it's something that benefits really everyone. Like, a lot of the men I know who were diagnosed quite late in life also were more on the verbal than mathematical level of fixation as a child and got me to that reason too. So I think knowledge is never bad, essentially, as long as people are cautious in how they handle it.
We're coming to the end, very sadly, of this conversation, but the final question I want to ask you is about specifically alonement. So that's a word that I invented to fill a gap in the English language where we say alone and we mean alone me time, not, you know, me again time like we were discussing earlier, but conscious, joyful, fulfilling alone time. What does that look like for you right now?
I really enjoy drawing for this. I think it's the perfect thing where I know enough and can do enough that I feel proud of the result at the end, but I'm not good enough for there to be any sort of urge to improve. Like, I'm pleased when I've noticed that I've improved, but I'm not at every turn doubting the last joke that I did or thinking about better jokes that I could have done instead. So it's like if I took a bunch of sleeping pills and then wrote fiction, except I don't need to because I'm bad. And being bad has, in this case, the slightly melodious effect of just taking one sleeping pills. So that's nice.
That's amazing. And does that, I don't know, I guess what you're saying is you're sort of like creating, while eluding that inner critic that sort of sits on our shoulder while we're writing something. Has that influenced your writing process at all and made that more of a fluid process?
Well, I don't know if I always consider it an inner critic. Like, certainly there are points in my writing where I am picking holes in myself in an unhelpful way. But I think more often it's just that I have access to enough terminology and enough examples of how various things have been done that every choice I could possibly make is at every point visible to me. And it's not necessarily unpleasant, but it's a much more higher energy pursuit. And I think for that reason, it will never be a truly relaxing experience for me, because even when it's free of anxiety as such, like even when I don't think that there's any way I could go drastically wrong, still making that choice is a really stimulating thing to do. Whereas when I'm drawing, I'm just kind of happy if it looks good.
Yeah. Yeah. I read somewhere in an interview you said that you, because you'd written your first book, Exciting Times, and it was a bestseller, you sort of had that, I don't know, I don't really know how you referred to it, like beginner's mindset, or, you know, confidence in your beginner state, and that made you feel more confident trying out other forms of creativity. Has that remained the case?
Well, I don't think it's to do with the book selling, because that kind of happened too late into my development as a writer to make a difference. Yeah. But I think it's more because I was never in any particular formal creative writing program. I had the assumption that everything that I did was going to suck, and I never had any expectation that it wouldn't. And if it's going to suck up front, then there's no point in fixating over something that will happen anyway. It's like constantly thinking about the fact that I'm going to die. So just leave that aside and get on with doing what you want, really. And that continues to be the case, because I think I could write something that was artistically worthless and conceivably as a thing that could happen in the universe, it could still sell. And so the fact that it is sold doesn't really make a difference. I still write with the assumption that it's going to suck, and therefore I can do what I want.
Spoken like a true artist, Nisha, I think. That's a creative manifesto if I never heard one. Thanks as ever for tuning in. I feel really privileged to have had the opportunity to catch up with Nisha during her busy book touring schedule. And I hope you had, excuse the pun, an exciting time listening to. Until next time, and if you'd like to stay in the fold and hear exclusive behind-the-scenes details about this podcast season, do subscribe to my newsletter at francescaspector.substack.com.